Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you with us on this Tuesday, September the 4th. It's coming up now on 10 minutes past 8 o'clock. So why do we spend so much money on toiletry items like soaps and shampoos and age-defying cosmetics, lotions and potions, and bubble bath too? And then we spend a bunch on going to the spa and getting massages and hanging out in the whirlpool. Why do we do this? We will talk this hour about the quest to be clean, our quest for cleaner bodies and cleaner souls. We will talk with a guest who has written the complete history of human hygiene from ancient times in Rome and Greece to 21st century cosmetics and trends. And we will welcome your participation. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. Our guest is Virginia Smith. She's a freelance historian who specializes in the history of personal hygiene. She was previously a fellow of the Wellcome Institute for the History of Medicine and is currently an honorary fellow at the Center for History and Public Health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. She is the author of the book Clean, A History of Personal Hygiene and Purity. And she joins us, I believe, from London. Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks a lot for being with us. Sounds like you're right here in the studio with me.
Good.
So I saw your book. It was around my birthday a few weeks ago, and I was browsing through the bookstore. And I was thinking at the time about getting older and all of the money I'm spending on toiletries to try to mask my age. And then I saw your book, and that's why one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you is this this quest to be young and clean and attractive. This has been with us since time began.
That's it. Literally since the animals began. I mean. The book starts with animals and ends with animals because we are all driven by the same desires to groom and preak and primp ourselves and find mates and look after our children and do all these things. And that's where the ideology of clean starts, if you like. It starts with our biology. So we're doing no more than generations upon generations of people have done for millions of years.
Yeah. You know, though, I'm married for just about 22 years now, and I've got my mate. How come I still care so much about what I look like?
Ah, well, it's all to do with status and power, you see. So the more attractive you can be and the more you remain attractive, especially in middle life where your status is probably very high, you will want to glamorize yourself just as much as you would when you were a teenager, perhaps. And then and it goes on to old age. But when you get very old, you really don't care about these things anymore. And it sort of declines.
Mm-hmm. Now, this
I
isn't...
don't like to say that, yeah. But it doesn't decline for us because we all pretty much stay on the glamour route until we're in our 80s, I should think.
I hope. Now, this is not just something for. This is not just something women care about. Men too. We're seeing stories
indeed.
Now where, is this a new trend or is this something we've seen through history where men are doing a lot of primping and pampering and such?
We see it through history. It comes and goes. I mean, there are sort of Puritan times when men don't glamorize themselves very much and. But that's not to say that they don't groom themselves extremely carefully. Also, the more powerful they are and the richer they are, the more they groom themselves. So what we're saying these days is really partly the result of a pretty high standard of living we've had over the last 20 to 30 years. And more younger men coming into money earlier and so on. And it's never been something that excluded men. If you go right back to the Greeks, who were their oils and perfumes and elegant stance, you know, it goes on. I don't know whether any men are listening, but they might not think that they would like to be thought of as a high-end groomers, but an awful lot of money being spent in men's cosmetics these days.
Yeah, have we ever seen anything like that? I'm trying to figure out if this is a 21st century thing where the amount of money and the amount of time we're spending on these types of products.
Think 18th century, for example, all the wigs and powders and patches and satins and brocades. That was a male fashion. It was only 19th century men who sort of turned out in black and white and so on. Like, where else could be? The Renaissance, when men wore ribbons and lace and had long hair and all that. And the 1960s also you could think of as a time of peacocking men. You could pick out quite a lot of periods, but there's quite often a reaction or swings of fashion, and the whole sort of glamour industry is sort of obscured a bit.
Mm-hmm. Now, well, how did you come to write a book on the history of personal hygiene?
Well, it was one of these things that was knocking around in history, just put into footnotes, really. It was always assumed to have something to do with the rising standard of living, but no one really proved it, and there wasn't any writing about it. And I started on it and found that there was so much to do and so many interesting stories that it took me 25 years to track it down. And it was just fascinating. It was like being an archaeologist. Everything you sort of turned over, there was something else underneath, you know. If you see, there are stories about sort of virginity and sports and house planning and architecture, all sorts of things all go into the history of hygiene. We have a narrow view of hygiene as being something that is just to do with germs and what you put in your fridge and how you clean your floor. But in the old days, I mean, even old days being, say, 100 years ago, it was to do with your health, your where you lived your life, whether you did sport and exercise, what you ate, how you, you know, what your passions and mental health was like, everything, air, diet, exercise, evacuations, and passions of the mind. Mm-hmm. And it was called the non-naturals, yeah. Theory of the non-naturals. But I've just tried to expand on that theory and try and remind people of what it used to be.
Yeah, talk about the bath routine and how you know how giving our kids a bath now in 2007 isn't all that different from the ancient Romans.
Well, it is different and it isn't different. It's the same in the sense that the Romans had, you know, plumbing. If you were rich, you had plumbing. If you were poor, you didn't have plumbing. The fact that we have these specially designed bathrooms and loads of hot water and loads of potions and lotions, you know, you could have found that in any Egyptian palace, ancient Egyptian palace or Roman villa, but there's just more of it. Everyone has a bathroom now. I think in the 1950s, I found some census figures which showed that 47% of the UK population did not have a fixed bath. I don't know what it was like in the States, but probably less than that. But a surprising number of rural places did not have running water. So what really is different is that running water and bathrooms are completely ubiquitous now, and we're so lucky to have them. Mm-hmm. And that's why we can dip our children in every morning and shower them all the time. And whereas before it used to be once a week, you know, because you had to lug the water in from the spring or from the tap outside or bring it up the stairs. So it's the technology that's changed more than the reasons for doing it.
We are talking with Virginia Smith. She is the author of the book Clean, A History of Personal Hygiene and Purity. And we welcome your thoughts and questions for her. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, 20 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, September the 4th. Coming up this afternoon, it's At Issue with Ben Marins. Coming up after 5 o'clock, Ben talks with the author of Sugarcane Academy, How a New Orleans Teacher and His Storm-Struck Students Created a School to Remember. That's coming up after 5 this afternoon. We're talking with Virginia Smith. She is author of Clean, A History of Personal Hygiene and Purity. And we welcome your thoughts and questions about this, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Why are we obsessed to be clean, or are we obsessed to be clean? Why do we do so much primping and brushing and bathing? And why do we visit hot springs and spas? And why do we try to find cosmetics that mask our age? How did we get to where we are today? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. And we'll go to the phones. Karen in Sturgeon Bay joins us first. Hi, Karen. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Can you hear me well?
You're breaking up, so please state your question as quickly as you can.
Okay. Here, let me get to a better spot. Well, I would like to say that there is a, in my estimation, there's a huge difference between the way we used to bathe in the old days, just maybe 100 years ago, and the way we bathe and take care of ourselves now, and the difference is history. The difference is the companies who've sold us the concept of soap and lotion, sold us the concept of petrochemical personal care products, synthetic fragrance, which is becoming such an issue with so many people, and you know, the idea that it really is clean to cover yourself in petrochemical surfactants and synthetic fragrances, which are bioaccumulative toxins. And I'd like to say that there is a the Environmental Working Group right now has put out a very interesting website where people can actually go to a searchable database.
You know, we did lose you, but I think, Karen, people got most of it, yes, except for the website, but that's okay.
Yes.
They can find that.
Yes.
The dangers of all of these lotions and potions and fragrances and chemicals, Virginia
Absolutely.
Smith?
Absolutely. Yes, I mean, they're... You have to say that there are differences between some of these products. I mean, the antibacterial products that we use in our homes are probably the most sort of powerful chemicals that we can use, whereas soap, for example, has been around for thousands of years and is basically a vegetable product which has a chemical, natural chemical compound composition. But she's quite right. I mean, we've got hundreds more things that are being put into soaps and so on. But we have to also remember there's been a strong organic backlash against this, and a great many products are not animal tested. They're not complicated. They've gone back to old recipes. And these are the ones that people are buying fastest of all. I think if you just use simple compounds rather than complicated ones, and don't use masses of stuff to disinfect your home, you would probably be erring on the side of safety. But it's a mess, partly a question of personal choice, obviously. But compared to the 1900s house, we have an awful lot of petrochemicals stacked inside our bathroom cabinets and our kitchen cabinets. So, yes, she's right in many ways, but it's something that's always been with us. I mean, the constituents of perfumes were known to many, you know, the ancient Greeks, the Egyptians, the Chinese, the Japanese, and so on. So it doesn't seem to harm the animal body. It sort of replaces the natural perfumes that the animal body gives off, but it does seem to be an important factor in making ourselves attractive and making ourselves feel attractive. And some people choose perfumes for life, and it becomes part of their personality, like their clothing or anything else. So it's a strange business, but we seem to have a sort of partial reliance on these artificial compounds and potions. But I think it's quantity is a problem rather than the quality of it.
Yeah. Are we cleaner?
She would accept that or not. Are we cleaner?
Yeah, are we cleaner?
Oh, much so. Mm-hmm. Oh, much so, I think so, yes. The amount of skin diseases and so on has gone down dramatically, even since post-war. And I think just the general effect of having so much water available, easily available in the home, has actually transformed our looks and our health.
Yeah, but your point in the book does, though, is that the bath itself has been with us, or this quest to be clean or to primp has been with us forever.
Forever, yes. Yeah. I mean, there is another form of cleaning which people probably don't really realise, which is sort of dry cleaning, which preceded sort of wet cleaning. To get a bath full of water is a pretty huge undertaking, if you think of it in a Neolithic sort of period. But people groom by changing their linen, by combing their hair, by rubbing with cloths, or oiling their skin as well. And that these are very ancient forms of cleaning. So it's quite an interesting idea that we dry clean as well as wet clean. So that's why we can survive in animals' sort of conditions when we have no hot water and so on, and still remain healthy. We just have to remember that underneath the hot water and the washes and the potions lie this very early animal grooming procedure.
Yeah, talk a little bit about the communal baths too. Mass numbers of people could attend. That maybe you would wash off some dirt, but that doesn't seem too cleanly. It doesn't seem very hygienic.
The very earliest hot spas that we were talking about. I've just been reading about the hot spas of the Northwest and the Southwest. Fabulous collection of thousands of hot spas. Much used by earlier tribal societies, as they were around the world in Japan and Russia and Finland and Italy and everywhere else. And these were not really washing occasions. They were social occasions, and tribes used to arrive at the hot spas and stay 1 or 2 weeks annually, and have a good time. And no doubt they held political meetings or parties or weddings or who knows what. But there are quite a lot of records of tribal ceremonies and activities around the hot spas. So this is where our sort of communal play, water play instinct comes in. And we still love to do it. I mean, apart from hot spas, there are the beaches, the seaside, where we all crowd into the beaches and have a great deal of fun and enjoy ourselves, not with any idea of cleanliness, but really as a sort of... play instinct, that's all I can call it, really. Mm-hmm. And it is one of these basic things that it brings a smile on everyone's face, you know.
Yeah, and we also, with some of these, that like the hot springs, we think there's medicinal properties in the water, don't we?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, in the time before antibiotics, this was quite an important factor. You know, if it smelt pretty awful, you could be sure it was doing you good. And for sulfur, sulfur springs, I believe, actually did have an effect on skin diseases in particular. Of course, it was the Romans who classified originally the mineral content of the springs, and then in subsequent centuries this was better known and reclassified, and it became a big thing in the 19th century to drink the water, as of course we all remember, with hope that it was going to cleanse your innards, not your outer self, but your inside self. And they drank fantastic quantities of water. I mean, pints and pints and pints every day. So goodness knows what it was doing, but it certainly would have sluiced them out pretty good and proper. So it wasn't so much, these natural springs were not so much body cleansers as for other purposes. But at the same time, if you were absolutely filthy, if you were a traveller and so on, you would probably hurl yourself into a river or a hot spring and obtain relief, because the body doesn't really like to be clogged up with dirt and grime and gunge for too long. It starts getting uncomfortable, and we usually take steps to do something about it.
We had a caller who couldn't hold on any longer, who wanted to know if you could tell her about the history of the sauna. Did you cover that?
Absolutely, I do. That comes into my bit about the hot springs, really, because the sauna is really what we'll call a stove, a hot stove, which the American Indians had, of course, as we know very well. And it seems to be part of the Neolithic culture, which crossed all the continent, from all South and North America and Eurasia. And that's where the sauna comes from, and that is an artificial method of creating what is in effect a hot bath or a hot spring bath. And that there's some wonderful books about saunas, and many extensive sort of cultures about, you know, like Japanese or Turkish or Russian or Finnish saunas tell you all about it.
Mm-hmm.
But it does what probably the hot spring could do, but many people couldn't find. You know, they were too far away from a hot spring, so they recreated it as they went and set up a little wigwam or something with a few hot stones and threw some water on the top, and in you went, and you stayed in there for a few hours, and then you got out and you went into the river, and then you were probably cured. You know, it was pretty
effective. Yeah, or threw yourself into the snow.
Indeed, mm-hmm. Yes. If there was no river, there would be snow. Mm-hmm. But the famous description by William Penn of an Indian chief who cured himself of a very long-standing illness by a whole lot of sessions in the stove that he'd built by the river, said he cast himself reeking into the cold water and emerged as good as ever.
Mm-hmm. Saunas
are great, but they're one of these artificial things that humans have built in imitation of what came naturally.
Our guest is Virginia Smith. She is author of the book Clean, A History of Personal Hygiene and Purity. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. If you have a question about our quest for cleanliness and how we got to where we are today. Carol in Appleton is our next caller. Hi, Carol. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm 67 years old, and when I was a child, we had no indoor plumbing. And for bath night, which was Saturday night, we brought in my mother's wash tub, and she'd heat the water on the stove. And I remember her collecting rainwater for our hair, and also in the winter we would melt big things of snow to get our baths. Mm. But we took this bath once a week, and the water was from the youngest child to the oldest child. And the water got dirtier and dirtier, and she would replenish it a little bit. But we'd also get our clean pajamas on that week because we wore our pajamas for a week. So I'm a little bit shocked in the culture today because of the waste that we do on water and all kinds of things. But I also watch movies, and I watch these fantasy movies. I just watched Marie Antoinette and Elizabeth I've watched, and I'm thinking about these people. They didn't have deodorant. They didn't have washers and dryers. I mean, this is fantasy. They had lost their teeth because of poor hygiene, and their clothing certainly was not changed every day. So can you talk about that a little bit?
By all means, yes. Actually, Elizabeth lost her teeth because she really liked sweets, and sugar had just been introduced into Europe, and that's they all lost their teeth. But they didn't have what we have, but they had hundreds of servants, and these servants constantly attended to them, and they changed their clothes, and they aired them, and they laundered them, and they were much cleaner than you might imagine. And in fact, it was during that period of the 16th, 17th century that it became a real fashion for the monarchies to have bathrooms. And Mary, Queen of Scots, had a bathroom specially built for her in Holyrood Palace, and so did Elizabeth. Elizabeth inherited three bathrooms from her father, Henry VIII. So it's a bit of a myth, that, about them being absolutely filthy. Marie Antoinette, of course, was in the heyday of the 18th century, and that was the time when the French invented the bidet, and she, you know, Louis XIV had bathrooms installed in every guest suite at Versailles, and so on and so forth. So it may have seemed that there was no attention to it, but I think this was a myth that the Victorians put about, really, because they thought that they were so much cleaner than everyone else that it must have been positively filthy before. But I don't know whether that answers your question. But we have to remember that one of the main things that helps us keep clean is the fact that people also help us. There's something called auto-grooming, which is what you do to yourself, and then there's something called allo-grooming, which is what people do to you or you do to other people. So you allo-groom when you're nursing your child or you're looking after your children or when you cut your husband's hair or mm-hmm. when you look after a teenager or teenagers on going out on Friday night, they allo-groom each other, you know, prinking and preening in front of the mirror, all sort of 8 of them or 16 of them or whatever. So having lots of people, having lots of servants means that you could keep pretty clean even though you can't just turn on a tap in your bathroom. We use all this water, and it's very interesting that the once a week bath routine mm-hmm. is within living memory, isn't it, really?
Yeah, now it's every day, isn't it?
Yeah, now it's every, we only do that because we can do it. Mm-hmm. That's a simple, you know, explanation. It's not really that we need it, and some people think that having too many showers is rather bad for the skin. It would be, I think, if you use too much soap and so on, which strip the skin of all its natural oils. But if you use less, it's less worrying, I think.
Carol, thank you very much for the call. John in Milwaukee is with us now. Hi, John.
Yeah, hi. You know, about 15 years ago, I read an article in the Smithsonian Magazine that suggested that, the premise of the article was that one of the greatest health advances we've had is washing and bathing in the last 1,000 years. And it suggested that the church, as an anti-Roman concept, really suppressed bathing for centuries. And the Puritans obviously took off on that. It was very a non-religious experience to bathe. And they even gave a quote. Now, you changed my thinking about this. They gave a quote from Napoleon that was coming home to see his wife. And it suggested that he wrote in his letter that I'll be home in 3 weeks. Don't bathe.
That's a very famous quote. That one, yes. That's all to do with the sexuality of dirt, really. Which I don't do dirt really in my book, but that is quite another matter. But
in the dirt was sexy then.
Well, dirt. It can be sexy, yes, it mm-hmm. is sexy. I mean, that's partly to do with the pheromones which all of us exude, which are hormonal musks, perfumes, which before the age of perfume, obviously, were crucial in helping to arouse sexual desire and so on. So there is a pretty sound biological reason for not washing in that, in that respect. But about the Puritans, yes, there's a whole story about Puritanism in the book, and it all hinges on the idea of asceticism, which came into the early church. And there was great battles fought about asceticism and whether you should cultivate the outer person or the inner person. Of course, ascetics only cultivate the inner person, and the outer person is as nothing. In fact, by the 17th, 18th century, the Puritanism we know, they really did not like communal water bathing. They thought that was unclean in a sexual sense. Mm-hmm. And their definition of cleanliness was pretty much sexual as well as physical. But they did encourage and want their followers to be clean privately. So instead of going to a public bath, you now had to wash in private, in your room. And that meant that a lot of working people in the towns didn't have access to public water supplies, because that was a great blow to those classes, because what had been supplied before had been taken away, and they were often in situations where they couldn't have access to clean water, even though all you really need is a bowl and a few pints of water. You put it in there and you could do a strip wash. But if you don't have the ability to get clean water or the space or the linen cloths for the towels, then you're stuck. So I think it did put off the cause of cleanliness for quite a while, and they did disapprove of warm water bathing. And it wasn't really to the 19th century, when science proved that warm water did a lot of good for skin diseases, that these old taboos and prejudices were finally broken. And it's a very strange story, but it's certainly all there in the records.
We are talking with Virginia Smith, author of Clean, A Personal History of Personal Hygiene and Purity, talking about our personal hygiene habits and our grooming routines and how we got to where we are today, our quest for clean bodies and surroundings. Virginia Smith, a freelance historian who specializes in the history of personal hygiene. She is currently an honorary fellow at the Center for History and Public Health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. 1-800-642-1234. We have a line open for you if you have a question for her or a comment in Madison 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Kathleen Dunn is with you. She will be talking with NPR political junkie Ken Rudin coming up after 9 o'clock. We're talking with Virginia Smith, author of the book Clean, A History of Personal Hygiene and Purity, and our next caller is Carol in Port Washington. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm wondering if you can tell us about the history of women shaving their legs and shaving their underarms, why it started.
Yeah, who started that anyway?
Oh, well, the ancient Egyptians were pretty hot on that. They hated hairy bodies, so they used all sorts of different techniques to strip their hair off the body. And also in India as well, the Aryan or the Vedic civilization there also despised a hairy body. I think it was something to do with making a distinction between man and animals that went right back in time. And so if you were urban livers, or urban, you know, civilized people, in 2000 BC, you would be taking the hair off your body and making it as smooth and silky as possible. And then after that, oiling and perfuming it as well, and clothing it, of course. You know, cloth was an invention of the Neolithic period in around 20,000 BC, and the gauzes and saris and everything that we know about from the ancient world were also signs of prestige. So it's a very, very, very old tradition. What fascinates me is its revival in the late 20th century. I seem to remember in the 1960s, no one really bothered much about it.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of a political statement.
Since then, yes, indeed. In fact, you know, I still think of it as slightly a bit of a chore that's forced on me by fashion. But now it's become de rigueur amongst young women. And a friend of mine in Spain said she was ticked off by her family for not having done her underarms and legs recently. She said, I didn't have time and I was living in Scotland and they don't care about these things there. You know? Mm-hmm. So it does depend where you are and, you know, which culture you're living in. And indeed, whether it's fashionable. But it does take time, and it is one of these luxury things which has become easier. It's much easier to use an electric machine now than it was when you used to have to smear horrible acids all over yourself.
Well, we might be getting a little bit risque for public radio, but having removing hair on the body is something that it's not just the underarms and legs anymore. You can go to a spa and have all sorts of things waxed.
Indeed, and that was one of the I talk about the courtesans or the ganika, as they were called in India, and that was one of their arts, high arts of body care, and it's the courtesans and the celebrities of their day who led the pursuit of perfection, really. And it was sort of, that was one of the arts of the body which became secret after the Protestant Reformation, was sort of hidden underground and was only known in aristocratic circles or amongst courtesans and prostitutes. And it's now become quite normal, as you say, and almost respectable in some circles.
Yeah, and as I recall a scene from the movie The 40-Year-Old Virgin, and where the star of that movie had his very hairy chest waxed and had, you know, hair removal done, and the pain that we'll go through to do this. I mean,
I know. It's just unbelievable, really. I mean, I think men do it now when they feel they're excessively hirsute.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not apparently acceptable these days, or in certain circles it's not acceptable. So it's not something that men do a lot of, I don't think. Although male cosmetic, the revival of male cosmetics has encouraged men to look at their skin in a rather sort of different way, almost like the Greeks, really. You know, they want to be bronzed and rippling and muscular and have all the definition of the muscles sort of brought out by regular exercise and grooming. So it's a fad. Mm-hmm. it'll change.
Nancy in Milwaukee is with us next. Hello, Nancy.
Good morning to you. My comments are about the fact that I feel we're getting, that women especially are getting a lot of very conflicting messages. Some manufacturers tell us that we are simply not all right the way we are. We need to be curled, deodorized, dehaired, oiled, cosmetic surgery, whatever it takes, because we're not basically all right the way we are as the way we came into the world. And the opposite of that is the manufacturer who puts out a product and tells us that we're worth it and we don't need to feel guilty about spending $22 for a bottle of shampoo because, after all, you're worth it. And I see these as very conflicting messages.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we have to remember that it's a big industry. It's a very ancient industry, but it's one that's turned itself around in the last 30 years and poured an awful lot of research development money into new products, and particularly products aimed at the mature woman and men, which were the slightly undeveloped markets. But I agree with you that to be told that you have to spend sort of $22 or double that on products, otherwise that you won't be fit to be seen, seems to be a bit of an oppression, if you like. At the same time, there are many more products which are relatively cheap, which do the same job, and you don't have to have large quantities of them to do a simple job anyway. And I feel that although the saturation of high-end products seems to be very great, we should perhaps not get carried away by the amount of advertising that's put into it, because actually, you know, 60% of women don't use the products, just as only apparently 15% of men use the male cosmetic products.
Mm.
So what you see on the ads and what is actually happening on the ground are two very different things.
Yeah, we are seeing a lot of ads, though, but not as you make note in the book that the very first television ad ever was one for soap.
Yes, that's right. Yes. And cosmetics ads are riding very high at the moment. Probably there are less soap powder ads than there were
for the soap opera.
But there are now cosmetic ads. That's correct.
Yeah. Mary in Madison. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. I have two questions. One is about what is the first mirror and comb ever discovered in the Stone Age? And don't our bodies shed skin cells? And that's kind of a natural cleaning, isn't it?
That's right. Yes, that's exactly where I start. Our body sheds all sorts of things. We evacuate through all the different orifices. I won't mention them all, but we know what they are, and that's the body doing the job itself. In fact, if you think about it, even when you take a breath of air and expel it, that is a form of evacuation, which is a form of cleansing. Mm-hmm. And so that's where the story starts. So that is an interesting point, and it's what I call inner cleanliness, and it's something that we're almost unconscious of. We can't control it. It happens without our say-so, and it's a wonderful, extraordinary system that the body has devised for expelling all the poisons, or at least the waste matter that we need to get rid of before we can bring in more food and air and so on. The point about the comb, well, the ancient Egyptians, again, around sort of 5,000 BC or so, were already starting to put combs into their burial and graves. The Celtic chiefs, about 2,000 years later, would be buried with their mirrors and their bone combs. When metal came in, that meant the amount of grave goods that indicated your favourite cosmetic possessions increased, so you'd have little buckets as well as little combs and little mirrors and so on. So it always was something that was valued. Of course, the original combs you have on the end of your hands, which are your nails and your fingers. And so, there's, you know, nature's thought of that as well. It's all built in.
We have an opening now for you, if you would like to talk with Virginia Smith, author of Clean, A History of Personal Hygiene and Purity, about how our hygiene habits have evolved over the years and why we do what we do today. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And please include your first name and your community with your email. I'm wondering, Virginia Smith, if we are too clean today, if we touched on it a little bit earlier in the program, but are we doing too much to ourselves, that we're actually doing ourselves some harm by trying to disinfect everything and to polish everything?
Well, there is something called the hygiene theory, which is started about 5 or 6 years ago, where they were trying to work out why rates of asthma in West Germany were so much higher than rates of asthma in East Germany. When West Germany had such high standard of living and East Germany did not. And they called it the hygiene theory because they reckoned that it was the fact that we are not triggering our immune systems quite so violently as we used to do in the past, and that therefore they weren't kicking into action in the children's physiology, and that they were therefore we were falling victim to some of these endemic or diseases like asthma and eczema and so on, but that doesn't account for the rising rates of diabetes, unfortunately, and things like that. So it is a theory which is under progress. It's not proven. A lot of people think that, like the lady caller before who talked about petrochemicals, think that chemicals have had an effect on the human physiology. Whether it's in drinking water that's recycled that has minute trace elements still there, or whether it's come through the air. And we know from, really right from going back to Rachel Carson's Silent Spring book, which had such an effect on the environmental movement, that we have been doing a lot of chemical polluting. How this has an effect on us or our children or our babies is not known in a sort of detailed sense. It will probably turn out that there's a sort of multi-causal explanation, that there are a lot of little tiny effects which mount up and maybe cause these things. But it's early days, really, yet. I personally would go easy on these antibacterial disinfectants because they are pretty strong. It's like putting sort of Jay's toilet fluid on your kitchen counter.
No, that'll.
They will wipe all germs free. But in that sense, we're a bit like our grandparents who were terrified of germs in the late 19th century once they'd been discovered to exist, and there was a terrific paranoia about germs, and probably not only our grandparents but our mothers went through that as well. This is why things were covered over with little lace doilies. This is why, your mother wouldn't kiss you because she was afraid of spreading germs, or you couldn't play with the person next door, or all these things. And germs was one of the reasons that skirt lengths went up as well, because it was believed that long skirts brushed the dust with dry germs straight into the house. So, of course, if you lifted the skirts up, that wouldn't happen. Mm. So we are pretty germ-obsessed now, but I think it's advertising-led, mostly.
Barbara in Superior is with us. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good show. I was wondering if there are different mores, ritual requirements, cross cultures for men and women, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
There are. There are things called purity rules, which anthropologists have discovered, which are embedded in most of the world's religions, and they take different forms in different religions, and some are more precise than others, and they more or less all have a division between men and women. Not all, because men are also have to be looked after as well in terms of their soul or their purification. But women, as you may well know, were considered particularly impure in because of their greater evacuations, and they had to, for example, be churched for a month after childbirth, or longer in some cases. And there are all sorts of myths surrounding the idea that women could, say, taint milk during the period of the menses, or so on and so forth. So there was a division, because all ancient societies had very strict divisions in terms of gender and rank and so on.
Let me take one more call before we're out of time. Raffi in West Bend. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm curious what your common term, sorry, I've forgotten your name, would have to say about...
Junior.
Thank you. What would you have to say about the Hebrews in the Bible? They, from my understanding, were a rather advanced culture for the time, with their appreciation for separation and cleanliness and quarantining necessitated. And I'll
indeed,
take the answers
yes,
off the air.
Mm-hmm.
And Judaic dietary laws are still very precise and still followed. And the Leviticus commands, which I think was what you're talking about, are very famous. They were talked about by an author called Mary Douglas in Purity and Danger, which brought purity and pollution rules into anthropology and made them very well known for the first time. So, yes, they were very pernickety, but you find, or the anthropologists have since found, there are many different rules, equally complex in many or all tribal societies, where purity roles are invoked. And you'd have to consider the Indian caste system as part of that system.
Yeah,
and that's just as distinct, and as Judaic rules.
We're going to have to leave it there.
Where you can do that, yeah.
We are out of time. Virginia Smith, thank you so much for being with us. We covered a lot of territory, and we barely scratched the surface of all the information in your book. Thanks very much. Virginia Smith, author of Clean, A History of Personal Hygiene and Purity. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing the hour and to Leo Duran for on-air production. Thank you for listening and for calling in. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.